Good morning, everybody. This is Lenny Lawson, the Car Guru, and I'm glad to be here with you this morning. And do want to mention just right off the bat for everybody to keep Tim Cable in your prayers. He and his wife, Christina. Tim is really fighting a battle with COVID right now, and he's been transferred from one hospital to another, and it's something that I just had to bring up. I know that this stuff is sometimes kept confidential, but there, I do believe in the power of prayer, and I know that if enough people petition for Tim, and you know that he'll get the comfort that he needs, and hopefully the healing that he needs. So, Tim Cable, we lift you up and pray for you and Christina. Now, I am a student of history, and I know Tim is as well. He is a collector of memorabilia. He loves to go. He and Christina both love to go out and go to estate sales and go to different events where they'll accumulate a bunch of stuff, and then they'll go have a sale, and so that they can, you know, get some money together, and so they can buy more stuff. I mean, this is just kind of the way it goes. I do the same thing with old cars. I'm not much of a purchaser of antiques and going to estate sales, but they are fascinating because of the history. To me, that's why I enjoy watching American Pickers and even Pawn Stars occasionally, because of what I learned watching those shows about history. I didn't become interested in history until I was completely out of school and started reading. My mom gave me a book that really kicked it off for me, and that book was titled April 1865, and it was about all the events that took place in April of 1865. And that was just like, you know, like I'm a big old wide-mouthed bass in the middle of a pond and somebody just throws the right bait. And that was the right bait for me when it comes to an interest in history. And then after that, I read Gods and Generals, which was another Civil War era type book. And then, I mean, it was just grabbing everything I could grab. Now, I am interested in, you know, I started to say other things that I'm interested in as far as history, but the car business has provided a lot of opportunities for me to explore my love of history, because the automobile has a very storied history, especially in this country. I mean, it didn't start here. I guess some Daimler or Gottlieb Daimler and some guy named Carl Benz were the first ones to create a production car. However, the industry exploded in this country. And I was just thinking the other day, what made Detroit become Motor City? You know, what was it about that city that you know, sometimes it's about the availability of raw materials and rivers and you know, other means of transportation that lead a particular area to become pivotal as far as either production or, you know, where people want to live, or, you know, what is the source of revenue for that area. Now, Detroit has remained synonymous basically with America's car industry through all of the economic highs and lows that we have had in this country. My dad and his mom and his dad lived in Detroit back in 1930. I'm looking right now at something I got off of Ancestry.com. You know, I've really enjoyed that too, diving into family history and building the family tree and all of that. But I won't go into the whole family tree, but interesting. This is actually the document of the 1930 census where they happened to hit my dad's street where they lived. And there's Joseph Lawson, my grandmother, and my dad. My dad, let's see, his dad was 25, my grandmother was 27, and my dad was 2 1/2. That's just so weird seeing that on there. But what amazed me about this particular document, I just started going down and looking at some of the names, and then I looked at where they came from. And there are 50 names on this particular sheet. It's all in beautiful handwriting, very easy to read. But there are 50 names. 21 of these people came from a different country and that lived on the same street that my dad lived on. Here's England, Canada, Croatia, Austria, Russia, Austria-Hungary, Greece, another Germany, Italy, Spain, another Croatia. You know, they were coming for a place to work. You think about, okay, this is 1930. What's going on then? The Great Depression. And my grandfather ended up being the, I've got a ring that my dad used to wear all the time, and I have it now, that is basically a ring that he got for being the number one salesperson for Chevrolet in the city of Detroit in 1932. Now, you know, when I think about that, I think, well, they couldn't have been selling that many cars, but they were still selling cars, and people were buying and living, and it's just that there was unemployment was extremely high, and it was tough, but they were still manufacturing cars, and maybe, and in fact, it was actually the golden era of production of luxury automobiles. But, you know, Detroit, at the dawn of the 20th century, it was the field was wide open, basically, as to where the car business was going to settle in, and we'll get into that here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back, you know, talking about how did Detroit end up becoming Motor City? And it still is to this day. And, you know, primarily because of three companies that ended up dominating the auto industry. But, you know, early companies like some of these names you've probably never heard of, the White Motor Company, Winton Motor Company, they were centered in Cleveland, Ohio. Indianapolis had some very prestigious automakers, Auburn, Cord, Duesenberg. Another interesting brand you may have never heard, sounds more like a train, Locomobile. And Mercer Motor Cars. They were manufacturers of some of the fastest cars that were ever built in that era. They came from Connecticut, New Jersey. Meanwhile, in Springfield, Massachusetts, a company called the DeRay Motor Company built the DeRay Motor Wagon. They would become recognized as the first serial production car sold in the U.S. Up to that point, American cars had pretty much been built to order, and this year was 1896 is what I'm talking about. They actually built 13 DeRay motor cars that found homes in 1896. But at the turn of the century, in 1900, there were three different types of propulsion systems that were fighting for dominance. One obviously was gasoline. The other was steam-powered cars, yeah, believe it or not, and electric cars. And they were all competing with each other on pretty much equal footing. Cleveland was probably the second runner-up to Detroit as far as having predominance in the electric car manufacturing. When gasoline gasoline automobile became predominant, then the majority of those manufacturers were actually located in Detroit. And guess what won out? Yep, the internal combustion engine. But asked what helped to establish gas-powered car supremacy, according to a guy named Bill Rothermel. He was the secretary of the board of directors of the Elegance at Hershey, Pennsylvania, which is a big, big car show, one of the biggest in the world. He said that what led to the predominance of gasoline cars was a company called Standard Oil. Basically, this oil giant was instrumental in building the infrastructure that was needed to make gasoline cars viable. In the days before dedicated filling stations, running out of gas meant that your best bet for a refill was maybe to go to the local pharmacy or the hardware store so you could buy some alcohol. But gas-fueled cars received a lot of help just because of practicality issues. Steam-powered cars were referred to in that time as time bombs due to they were just extremely complex mechanically. They had bubbling boilers, not the least of which a laborious starting process that usually required about 20 minutes to get it fired up, get enough heat going so that the car could be driven. Electric cars, while a lot quieter and cleaner than steam or gas, they had the same limited driving range and lengthy charging issues. Just kind of hard to believe that back in that day that we had electric cars, but it's true. Electric cars are nothing new. Logistics and good timing played a lot of vital roles in the rise of Detroit also. Halfway between the coal fields of Kentucky and the iron ore from Minnesota and Wisconsin, Detroit had also a very extensive network of railroads. And then you have the easy transportation of the Great Lakes, so that made a big difference. The physical location of Detroit made a difference also. It's kind of right in the middle of the country, along with the city's already industrial strengths. And so a lot of machinery was being built there. Tobacco was a big business. Stoves were also one of Detroit's biggest business. And by 1900, one-third of the residents that lived in Detroit were foreign-born. You had a lot of people coming over, and that's what made me kind of pull this this census report. I had remembered seeing this when I was going through Ancestry.com, and I hoped that I could find it. They make it pretty easy to find this stuff. If you've not ever used Ancestry.com, you ought to, because it's a good way to build your family tree and see all of these handwritten documents and gravestones and stuff. You know, just about every gravestone in this country has been photographed and is posted on online, and you can find them and you can see them. So if you had a relative that, you know, was buried in Washington State and you're here, you can see it. You can actually visit the grave if you want to. But anyway, in terms of product and sheer sales figures, the Model T Ford, above all others, is basically credited with cementing Detroit's legacy. Yet before getting to Henry's breakthrough, a lesser known and no less revolutionary automobile deserves recognition, and that was built between 1901 and 1907 and was built by Oldsmobile, the curved dash Oldsmobile. It basically initiated massive changes in the way cars were built and also how they were enjoyed. They were light. They were simple to drive. It was a very affordable car. And you didn't have to be some kind of a lumber baron or a railroad tycoon to afford one. Car buyers were finally becoming car drivers, the elite chauffeur-driven crowd. And there were plenty of those that people didn't want to drive cars. They just wanted to ride in them. But people found that driving a car was fun and something that they could do on the spur of the moment. I don't think they had 7-Elevens back then. But they could get around and go where they wanted to go and get there a lot faster if the horse was not cooperating. But it was the curved dash Oldsmobile that showed the world that the automobile was not just a toy for rich folks. It also pioneered the use of interchangeable parts and quality control, and even the beginnings of the auto assembly line. Henry Ford is credited with perfecting the auto assembly line up to that point in time and to make be able to manufacture millions and millions of cars. But Oldsmobile was one of the first ones to actually be able to be built in a factory in stations, with the car being moved on rollers from one station to the other until it was complete. And it was by far and away the easiest car to drive of the era. It just had one lever, no clutch. It was very easy to use for machinery of the day. And it was rugged, tough. It was could be fixed by a good blacksmith in any village in the country. But by the time the Model T entered production in 1908, the tide was already turning well and truly in Detroit's favor. The Model T, if anything, was icing on the cake on its way to become known as Motor City. There was simply the Ford Motor Company just sold loads of Model Ts, more than 19 million by the time production ended in 1927. And, of course, the base price became cheaper and cheaper almost every year. The Model T absolutely revolutionized every aspect of the auto industry, from how cars were built to the assembly line workers' lives. It changed the lives of people who previously could not afford a reliable, simple car. Henry was no dummy, and he understood that if the people building his Ford cars, his Model Ts, couldn't afford to buy them, then who is he going to sell them to? So he increased their wages. He was the first to institute the $5 a day wage. Now they're talking about $15 an hour, but how about working your rear end off for $5 a day? Also, the moving assembly line, the five-day work week, rugged and easy-to-fix mechanical parts, the $5 payday, and not to mention a job with Ford, which was a enviable position to be in. And so, you know, workers started to be able to enjoy the fruits of their labor more so because of Henry Ford. This led to a lot more highly skilled workers entering the automotive workplace, and they came from all over the place. And as I said, on my dad's census page, you see all these people coming from all these different companies. And so it wiped out, you know, because of the success of the bigger players, it wiped out the smaller players. It's estimated that roughly 2,000 automobile companies had come and gone over the years. Some were giant companies that lasted for decades, and others only backyard shops with a car or two to their credit. But engineering advancements, the Great Depression, two world wars, occasionally cutthroat business maneuvers would winnow the field down to less than just a handful of key players. And so that's what ended up happening. You had men like Henry Ford, the Dodge brothers, Ransom Olds, Henry Leyland, who was the founder of Cadillac and also eventually Lincoln, and Billy Durant, who was a co-founder of both General Motors and Chevrolet. So just as far as, you know, the background of how a place becomes what it is, you know, you look up in East Tennessee, for example. I've always wondered how, you know, the Tri-Cities happened to be what they are today, you know, with I know Kingsport was primarily driven by Eastman. Bristol, I'm really not sure, you know, what the driving industry was in Bristol. I know in Johnson City, you know, is now the largest individual city, and it's become the retail hub of the Tri-Cities, and you know, the bigger hospitals and stuff are there now. But it was just a dinky little town, you know, in the old days, I guess it was a toss-up. I know that multiple railroads went through Johnson City, and that had an impact. You know, we'd think that Jonesboro, because it was the first town, would have become the largest. Or Greenville. You know, Greenville was the capital of the state of Franklin, and, you know, we did have a president from here, Andrew Johnson. So anyway, most other places can't claim that. So you wonder why something becomes what it is. I was thinking also, how in the world did Pigeon Forge get to be what it is? And, you know, some wise person probably said, well, what do you say we put up a go-kart track? You know, we're close to the Smoky Mountains. Let's give somebody souvenirs or something, some spears and bows and arrows and things like that that people can stop and buy. And look what it is today. Thank you, Dolly Parton. You could have put that place anywhere. I guess she probably put it there because she was from there. Of course, Henry Ford was from Dearborn, Michigan. So, well, not originally, but they did have a farm there, and his home was there, and that's what he determined to. He was determined to turn Dearborn, Michigan, into the center of the world, and he was close, you know, with all the other makers centering in and around Detroit. It has become quite that, and Detroit has really fallen on hard times over the years, especially in the last few decades. If you have not been to Detroit, there is a lot there to see. Probably one of the most interesting things to see there is in Dearborn, which is just outside of Detroit, is the Henry Ford Museum. And I've talked about that before on this radio show. But the Henry Ford and Greenfield Village, it is an amazing reproduction. And also some of the original structures that were torn down and reinstalled at Greenfield Village, of some of the most famous homes and famous places in this country. And so, you know, with friends like Thomas Edison and Harvey Firestone and all those other great people, he had plenty of resources to choose from when it came to putting together a museum. And it's definitely worth seeing. So anyway, we'll take our last break and be back here in just a minute. Okay, I'm back, folks. I apologize if I sound a little down today. I'm not really down. I'm just concerned, you know, about some people, especially Tim and other people that I know that are struggling with COVID. And also I'm thinking a lot about anybody that takes care of the sick, especially those who work in the hospitals, in the emergency rooms, in those care facilities that, you know, they're exposed to the virus. And this thing is really getting aggressive. And, I mean, it's way beyond that now, where you have hospitals that are absolutely full and emergency rooms that can't take anybody else. And, you know, it's just, it's scary where we are right now. And I just encourage you, if you have not had the shot, get the shot. You know, it's just like the bulletproof vest. You can still get shot in the arm or the leg or, you know, maybe even in the head, hopefully not. But if you get shot in the chest, you have a chance of surviving. And if somebody offered me a bulletproof vest, I'd take it. And I think that's kind of what the vaccine is. And so there's no reason not to do it. I don't think it's going to change our genetic code or anything. So, but it does make a difference. I was going to read you some statistics of from my daughter's really good friend, who's a critical care nurse, and she's been working in the emergency room, and it's just amazing the survivability, that the improvements that you get in survivability if you've had the vaccine. Of 430 hospitalized recently, 34 were vaccinated. Of 100 in the ICU, 7 were vaccinated, and of 54 that were on ventilators, only two had been vaccinated. So they probably had some kind of a pre-existing problem. So I think it improves your odds. It is a bulletproof vest, and I think it's something folks ought to at least consider. But anyway, pray for Tim Cable and his wife Christina, and that they'll be strong and return to full health as for those caregivers that are in the hospital trying to keep us all going. Well, we'll see you tomorrow, and I appreciate you listening.